Hey everyone, today's Real Vision Daily Briefing is sponsored by Crane Shares. Learn about their KRBN ETF at craneshares.com/KRBN. Now to the day's top analysis of today's markets.
Is the Fed damned if they do and damned if they don't? Welcome to the Real Vision Daily Briefing. It's Tuesday, March 21, 2023. I'm Ash Bennington. Today, I'm joined by Jeremy Schwartz, Global Chief Investment Officer at WisdomTree Asset Management. Jeremy, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me, Ash. Pleasure to be with you.
Well, I apologize for having you on such a slow news week. I know there's not a lot happening out there.
Nothing to talk about.
Nothing at all to talk about. Looks like we're going a little bit risk on here at the end of the day. S&P, NASDAQ, and Dow all up. I'll call it between approximately 1% and about 1.5% on the day. Lots happening. Obviously, major decision coming from the Fed tomorrow. Jeremy, big picture, where do you think we are right now?
Well, you know, there's all these questions about with this banking panic and crisis, how much is resolved, how much is behind us. And we can talk more about all the issues, what they really need to do to solve some of the issues. There's a lot to discuss on that. Clearly, the Fed meeting, you say the positive silver lining, if you take a positive view, and I do think the Fed's going to go 25 tomorrow. That is largely what's now priced into the Fed fund futures. And we were thinking that, you know, coming into this week that absent a much bigger crisis blow up, and is Credit Suisse part of that? Not really. But the 25 basis points was going to be the Fed's going to say they've got the tools to deal with financial stability. They're still sticking
today's
with the
show
inflation
is sponsored
fight,
by
but they're going to be dependent. You know, they're going to look at this uncertainty. We expect them to pause at the next meeting. We actually think they could be cutting soon thereafter. You know, because our view was that inflation was coming way down, much more than the official statistics say. We were calling for the Fed to pause coming into the year. Now, the employment data stayed very robust, so it was hard for that narrative to come in the data. Our narrative was definitely challenged, even ahead of this crisis. But, you know, I think it got to lead to some tightening of the conditions. I mean, there's some economists have pointed out saying it's as much as 6 tightenings. The Apollo chief economist put out a note saying 150 basis points of hikes from tightening lending standards. The other side of that trade, you would say, well, rates are falling. I mean, the 2-year is falling. They're expecting cuts now in the market. The mortgage rates are falling. They're going to fall more because of how much, you know, just long rates have fallen. So there is some elements that, you know, financial conditions have loosened. So Powell could really make, you know, to your point, like Powell could make any, you know, and rationalize, and it would make sense. You know, it would make sense if he continued his inflation fight and went 25. It would make sense if he paused and said, we need to see the cumulative impact of our tightening because we've already tightened so much. We've got to see the impact. And, you know, obviously he is seeing the impact. You know, but there's people who worry that if he were to pause now, does the Fed know something that's much more concerned? They should stick course like the ECB hiked 50. That's largely why we think they're doing the 25, even though, you know, again, we think inflation is no longer an issue and they should be pausing now.
So let me bring it in to sort of layman's terms here. Obviously, right now, the current federal funds rate between 450 and 475. 475 is the upper bound. Expectations in terms of what's priced in looks like going to 500 basis points, 5% even. But this is the point you were making in the forward curve. I'm looking right now at the expected future path of the 3-month average Fed funds rate on the Atlanta Fed website, a great alternative to see this if you don't have a Bloomberg terminal. And what you see right very clearly is it rolling down. When we get out to 2025, the expected average, 294. I mean, 200 basis points lower. So what do you make of this weird environment where the expectation is that the Fed is going to hike and then we're going to see, all of these rate hikes, all these rate cuts, I should say, going forward, 4 at 25, or it's rather 8 at 25 if it's 200. I mean, these are really wild, like almost meme stock swings that we're seeing in the 2-year treasury yield, something that has been bandied about on Twitter today, the idea of the 2-year treasury as a meme stock. How do you price, think about, and understand all this volatility?
And that's another big point, a great point, Ash, on, you know, people have said, are we going to get the VIX capitulation, the VIX being the volatility index, being one of those fear gauges, and people have been waiting. Well, do we know the pain is over until VIX spikes above 40, above 50? Those are like the real signs of panic. And there's all these other interrelated questions of people now trading those zero DTE, the zero date options, and is that suppressing the VIX? But what is not suppressed is bond volatility. The MOVE index has been like all, really, really high levels in terms of just the overall level of bond. You're seeing swings in that 2-year that you really haven't seen in a very, very long time. So the macro trades are back, and understanding those pressures are there. I mean, we do think what now being priced in futures is directionally, we agree with that. And with anything, I would probably say our view on inflation was, it was so backwards looking. The Fed was so backwards looking. They missed the big pop in 2021 when they should have been much more aggressive, when real estate was going off the charts. And then when meme stocks were going off the charts, when everything was flying, there was a lot of inflation in the system. They were saying it was transitory. Now they're stuck with this. Inflation is very high. And our view is that it's coming back in serious fashion, particularly if they used real-time data on housing, which is a big part of the core CPI. I mean, as much as 40% of core CPI is numbers that are just ridiculous, that are not anywhere near reality. Reality would say housing is coming down. It's come down for like 5 to 6 months in a row, and core CPI would be coming down 5 months in a row, not printing at like 5% annualized rates. If you look at the trailing 3 months, it would be like zero to negative and more negative. So, that's partly been our view on where the inflation fight was missed before. They're now overly fighting. So again, we would like them to pause. They'll still go 25 because of, their narratives. They haven't come to this new narrative. Although Powell is, to his credit, did say we're looking at core services ex shelter because of all this commentary people like us have been giving on housing. That he's recognizing housing is a distorted field. It's going to come back over the course of the year. It just baked in the cards. But it's going to still print high. The official data will still print high for who knows how many more months, maybe another 6 months, maybe longer, but the real-time data is coming way down. So, hopefully, you can say again, the silver lining is that they're going to have to do less. And so if the Fed was one of the big risks, it's much better that this crisis came sooner than later, and it's waking them up to, the issues that they've been creating.
Yeah, I was reading Diana Olick over at CNBC, who really is great on housing. Her headline is, home prices spiked 14.5% in February as the median price drops for the first time in over a decade, with rate pressure being cited as one of the primary drivers.
Yeah, I mean, okay, so they've cooled off a little bit, but rates are still way higher than where they were. And, so you had a 40% increase in home prices from March of 2020 to March of 2022 with the Case-Shiller index. That's been backing off just a few percent. You wouldn't be surprised to see that back off 10%. I mean, there are people who say, hey, there's just not enough supply. There's still strong underlying demand. And, I'm sympathetic to that argument that there is not a huge amount of supply, and the demographics do have a longer term tailwind for housing demand. And so that's, you say, hey, maybe that's the reason why housing prices aren't falling more, is that there is still underlying demand, and COVID has changed all sorts of housing consumption needs. You question how long this work from home trade will last, but it's been lasting and surprising. And so that in some ways has increased demand for housing in many ways. But the higher mortgage rates is no question is a direct cost on how much home you could afford. And so we would expect the housing to still come down maybe 10% from the peak.
Yeah, I've said this before on the show. People don't generally price houses in terms of purchase price. They price them in terms of monthly payment. And obviously interest rates being a huge constituent of that. By the way, I don't know if we can get the chart up on the screen on such short notice, but I was just looking at the S&P Case-Shiller, the U.S. National version of that index. And what you see is this, obviously, this just parabolic spike upward and then a leg down. So as you pointed out, clearly this is from this massive, massive boom, not just in the post-COVID era, or I should say not just during the COVID era, post-COVID being the slight rollover that we're seeing now, but also really since the beginning of the 2007-2008 ultra-accommodative monetary policy. And there it is up on the screen, because we have absolutely amazing producers who are able to turn this stuff around really quickly.
You want to know an interesting factoid about the Case-Shiller increase? Is it went up about 40% from March of 2020 to March of 2022. Do you know also what went up about 40%? The money supply, the M2 money right. supply from March of 2020 also went up just about 40% over the same exact time period. Now, this is the indicator where I said the Fed should have been a lot more worried about inflation in 2021. Than they were. They say the money supply has no relationship to inflation. It's very baffling that they say that. But this is also why now the money supply M2 is going down. You could pull that up on there too. And it also would show it's going down. And you know, the year over year is going down at levels you haven't seen since the Great Depression. I mean, this should really concern the Fed. And this is symbolic of what's going on in the banking situation in many ways. I mean, the money supply down 2%, you want the money supply growing 5% a year. During the 70s and 80s, you know, the money supply was growing 10% a year, basically, and you had inflation of 7.5%, 7%. And the difference was the real growth in the economy. You know, when you talk about 2-3% inflation, 2-3% real growth in the economy, that's what gets you the 5% money supply. Again, the money supply is now declining year over year. That should concern the Fed. And what does that represent? It represents that banks are making less loans. You know, they're supplying less loans to the economy. And that's a reflection of the tighter monetary conditions. In COVID, we had all these relief measures, all this fiscal support to support the economy, which was needed. The Fed financed it by buying all the bonds, keeping interest rates much lower than they needed to be. And so the Fed had a role. The government was creating the fiscal stimulus that put the money in people's checking accounts. Now it's sort of too tight. You know, the loans, the cost of borrowing too high, and people are taking out less loans. And there's no question all the current situation is going to lead to more of that tighter.
Right.
This goes back to Thorsten Stock's point that tighter lending standards could be as much as 6 cumulative rate hikes, which is such a big number.
We're going to take a quick break and be right back with more of the day's top analysis on the Real Vision Daily Briefing.
Have you ever experienced turbulence on a flight and wondered why?
And you can see all the terrain around you. You've got no issue with visibility or anything?
No, everything's peachy.
Maybe you've sat on the tarmac for hours wondering why your plane isn't moving.
Well, we're outside here. They're saying the ramp is closed. They won't let us park because of Air Force One.
Listen in on the conversations between pilots and air traffic controllers on the Air Traffic Out of Control podcast.
510 is declaring an emergency. There's smoke in the cabin. I need to make a landing right now on 31 left.
We have the most interesting, wild, and funny ATC recordings you will ever hear. Check out Air Traffic Out of Control wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Let's just go back for one second to the Case-Shiller chart, if we could bring that back up, because I wanted to make this point while you're talking about historical comparisons. We'll just wait a second so we can get that up on screen if we can. But what's interesting about that chart is you see that little hump peaking out, whatever it is, late 2006, early 2007. That was the greatest housing bubble in the history of the world. And then you see that parabolic upside after the that gray bar there, which represents recession when you start to see ultra accommodative monetary policy. And then you see this massive parabolic roll up from, you know, beginning around, we'll call it 2009 or thereabout.
You know, the cost of debt, as we've talked about, is a key factor. I mean, I definitely thought about myself, you know, how much are you paying on interest? How much less are we paying today versus what we had before? It's definitely a key factor, as you said, that you're thinking about your interest servicing cost as a really a key factor. In terms of the you know, how much extra housing demand do we have from the pandemic? I don't know if you have a view on the supply issue versus demand, how much of the support will come from just this lack of supply that people talk about in the, in their local markets.
I'm not smart enough to understand the structural dynamics of supply and demand in the housing market, but I always love having experts on these shows to talk about them. By the way, I just wanted to bring up this other chart that you mentioned there, which is the velocity of the M2 money stock, where you do see that dramatic collapse there that we're looking at right now. I don't know if that's up on screen, but just to bring that up, really a quite, oh, there we go, beautiful, a quite striking chart to your earlier point.
And so the velocity is one thing and the level of the money supply is another. So there's this formula, MV equals PY. So velocity is the V in that formula, MV, M is the money supply number. And so the two of those, the changes, when you do the change in money supply, the change in velocity should be equal to the change in inflation and the change in the real growth in the economy. So velocity is another variable that's sort of independent of the money supply variable. Yep. But the, you know, and certainly you saw that collapse. It's been trending down for some time. You could argue is a deflationary force, even if money supply was constant. You know, there's a question of should it resume back upwards to some of the trend with the reopening of the economies. You know, some of it shut down because, you know, we shut down the economy, and that's obviously where you see the 2020 fall off the cliff. But you know, the money supply number itself is another number, is the one that you want growing at 5% a year, essentially.
Yeah, as you say, that basic money MV equals PQ equation, talking about the relationship of pricing to the velocity of the money relative to the actual aggregate supply of the money supply. So let's take a look. I wanted to talk this through and bring it back to kind of the current news cycle, where we have lots of really interesting context on macro, but I want to bring this back to where we are tomorrow. This is a clip from a conversation that I had with Nouriel Roubini airing live, or I should say aired today, one day after it was filmed yesterday on the Real Vision platform. This is a deep dive. Nouriel Roubini, risk in the age of bank failure. This is a conversation I had with Nouriel yesterday. Let's take a look at the clip.
Now, whether the Fed is going to stay on hold this time around or raise rates by 25, 50 is off the table. In some sense, it doesn't matter, because even if you do zero or 25, you're still going to be in trouble. Be in trouble because inflation is still too high, and you should be raising rates all the way, not just to 5, you have to raise rates all the way to 6% if you're serious about inflation. But with rates already in the 4.5 range, we're already seeing cracks in the financial system, let alone if you were to go to 5, 5.5, and 6. And therefore, this trilemma to fight inflation, we're going to cause a recession and a financial crisis, now has become worse given the events of the last couple of weeks. And either way, we're going to have a hard landing of the economy and of financial markets. Central banks are damn if they do, damn if they don't. They were in a pickle before, they are now in a worse pickle. So there is no easy way out of it, because the forces that lead to inflation are there, the forces that lead to recession and stagflation are there, and the forces that lead to financial instability, high private and public debt, are historic. They've been going on for decades, so you cannot resolve them overnight. So either way, you get the hard landing of the real economy and or of financial markets.
Sobering remarks from Nouriel Roubini, talking about this as a trilemma, an impossible trinity, the idea that you're trying to balance price stability with not creating an economic collapse while simultaneously attempting to solve for bank solvency. Quite a framework that he's bringing to the table.
I'll say two things on that, if I can, Ash. I mean, I think one is, you know, I gave my view that inflation's coming down, so the Fed should be pausing. I don't think they have to really worry as much, but hey, that'll be proven out over time. What does inflation actually do over the next 12 months? And, you know, and we see the impact of their tightening. But the question on the banks, I mean, is where I'm actually probably share some more concern, and not because I fear for their solvency today And I think people should be panicking about their bank deposits. I mean, I think we're going to take more measures. I think that eventually we'll raise the FDIC limit. I think they're going to do, they showed very quick action in the scheme of things for getting, you know, for putting Silicon Valley Bank depositors' minds at ease, as well as Signature Banks. I think they're going to take increasingly more action. So I'm not worried from that perspective. What I do think is a challenge for banks, and you know, you go back to the 80s, this wasn't true. Back in the 80s, we had double-digit Fed funds rates. And you know what your checking account paid you? It paid you double digits. And they actually passed along the Fed rate hikes to their consumers. Do you know what your checking accounts now are paying you? I mean, I'm moving back and forth money from my checking account to treasuries more than I've ever, I mean, I never did that before this last, call it 6 months ago.
Yeah.
And now you should, and it's not because you're fearing for the bank's safety, it's because they're not paying you 5%, which is what they'll be paying you at the Fed tomorrow. And so, you know, you should be buying, you know, is your money market fund get you close to 5%? Maybe that's the easiest thing. There's short duration treasury products. We have a treasury product, USFR, that has 1 week duration, is floating rate treasuries. And it's the highest yielding treasury security that's there right now because of the inverted yield curve. So with 1 week duration, it is as a thoughtful thing for how do you manage your short duration cash as right. anything, getting 5%. And so that is pressure for the banks. I mean, that's going to continue to be there. So they right. now the banks should just pass along that. They should raise their what they pay. That's raising their cost of capital. It's going to hurt their profits, which is why they're not doing it. You know, and yeah. so
it's all about the net interest margins. I mean, there was a period there during the pandemic where you were lucky if you got double digit basis point return on accounts when you saw rates at this historic lows.
Just a quick moment to remind you, today's Real Vision Daily Briefing is sponsored by Crane Shares. Learn about their KRBN ETF at craneshares.com/KRBN. Now back to today's analysis.
Listen, I want to talk a little bit about banking since you bring it up. There are a couple of stories in the news cycle today. First one, First Republic rallying almost 30% on the day on news of this private sector potential investment. Remarks out from the Secretary of Treasury, Janet Yellen, saying essentially that they are open to backstopping more depositors should the need arise, hoping to, I would imagine, send a signal to smaller banks, regional banks, that there is support in the event that it is needed. And finally, something that we were talking about a little bit off camera, this idea of what happened over at Credit Suisse, the idea of the AT1 bonds getting essentially wiped out. You and I were talking a little bit about this because I think this has confused a lot of people in terms of understanding the bank capital stack, how it works, who absorbs first losses, second losses, and why. Talk a little bit about that, Jeremy.
Well, first I'll just say that Yellen's eventually going, they're going to need it. They need to do the higher deposit limit. So she's playing the cards. It's going to come out eventually. They absolutely need it. And because of this issue that we're talking about here about the 5%, they need to pay deposits. Now, the capital structure, you know, for Europe, it's a very interesting, you saw, this is one of the most interesting stories of this entire crisis and Credit Suisse story. I mean, Credit Suisse has been known to be an issue for a while. And, you know, you think about your traditional equity has different tiers. There's sort of preferred equity. There's common equity. The preferred equity tends to have some favoritism over traditional common, some other protections that get paid and dividends paid ahead of the common equity. You know, and common equity should be wiped out last. You know, preferred equity would have some preference. That's why it's called preferred, preference over the traditional equity. And, you know, at the top, you see things like senior secured debt, the deposits, and then various levels of unsecured debt, subordinated debt. Then you have what's called tier two, an additional tier one capital. And during some of the last financial crisis, there was questions of how can you automatically have some stabilizers and who you quote unquote bail in, who you wipe out, so you make the capital more sustainable. And they called them contingent convertibles, contingent on certain things happening. Some of them were capital triggers. And so there's what's called core tier one capital in the sort of acronyms SETI, you know, SET1 or CET1, core tier one capital. And, you know, that level was something like 7%. And their numbers were, at Credit Suisse, were like 14%. So you say, hey, this looked pretty safe. 14%, my buffer is 7. Unless there becomes some, in some of these documents, they had what's called temporary write-downs and permanent write-downs of the debt so that you can make these things more sustainable. And you know, one of the clauses in the Credit Suisse documents were if there's particular government intervention and support for it being a going concern, it could get wiped out. And so what you end up having this situation where, you know, automatically, you know, this COCO contingent convertible bond was wiped out. It got zeroed out. It made it more sustainable bank because they had less debt. You know, the liabilities were automatically triggered. And then the equity values had some value. And you know, I was actually with an employee today of one of these banks who was paid in some of these things, and he was reading the documents closely, and it was something they knew that was something that would happen. So it's interesting. You know, I think there's not a lot of vehicles that provide exposure to this. Our team in Europe was, you know, we've always tried to provide innovative exposures. You know, I mentioned that floating rate treasury year would issue that the day the government started issuing those treasuries. And there was not a lot of direct access vehicles to this tier one capital. And we sort of had one of the broader unique exposures. I think in times like this, ETFs are really a great way to track what's going on in the market to get real-time pricing. You know, people have talked about even the high yield bond ETFs being indicative pricing where the bonds would trade because the bonds don't trade all that much. And then you can use the high yield ETF to see where the bond should be trading. And that's, I think, what was happening yesterday morning. You saw some of these usage strategies trade down 15% and close closer to unchanged or, you know, a few percent down, you know. And,
yeah,
and
it is fascinating to see the difference in liquidity between the ETF and the underlying. I actually wrote a bit about this in my book with Harry Krishnan the last year to talk about precisely that point.
We're going to take another quick break and be right back with more of the day's top analysis on the Real Vision Daily Briefing.
Listen, we've got a lot of questions that are flowing into us, and I know we've got only about 5 minutes left, but I would love to do a quick speed round with you, Jeremy. Please. To see if we can get some answers to these, some really interesting questions here. Boy, this is a tough question to do in a speed round, but it's a good one. This one comes to us from Paul English. How will the commercial real estate train wreck get cleaned up?
Yeah, over time. I mean, it is an issue. I mean, we definitely, as an example, went remote first. We used to have room for 150 people. Now we have room for 50 people. And you know how many people are here today? Maybe less than 10. You know, the work from home mentality works for us. Now, the question is, are we an outlier or are other companies going to do more of that? And so I think over time, I mean, so far, this banking situation has really just been treasuries being marked to market. This has not been at all loan delinquencies or anything. So this, you know, in many ways could be early in the banking dynamic, particularly as you get a slowdown and recession from the Fed being too tight. So I think it's an overtime situation. And there's still a lot of issues, I think, in that segment.
Yeah, obviously, this is something that Real Vision has been dealing with as well. And I think we've landed in the same place that you have over at WisdomTree, which is this idea that people like working from home. They're productive working from home. You get to save a lot of money on real estate. You get to reduce commuting time, which means people can spend more time working and less time being miserable on New Jersey Transit or the LIRR or Metro North or wherever.
Win-win-win.
Win-win-win across the board. Exactly. Here's a question that comes to us from Bo Nito. Ash, as a fund manager, does Jeremy have an opinion of Biden's veto on the reverse ESG investing rule?
It's interesting, and it's obviously a polar topic in the U.S. We politicize everything. In Europe, if you don't have ESG...
Well, let's tell people what it is first.
Yep. So ESG is environment, social, governance. That's what it stands for. There's been all sorts of filters for ESG rules and compliance. And there's scores, and certain sectors are viewed as, you know, you could say, trying to, what are polluters? So they kick out a lot of energy stocks. In the governance, it's, you know, there's principles of the United Nations, got 17 principles of conduct and standards. And, you know, there's firms like Sustainalytics, bought by Morningstar, that provide, are these companies violating these 17 principles of, you know, sort of general standards? That's sort of like a governance or a social score. There's a lot of it focuses on the E because that's the most measurable. So what's happening in the environment, but some of it will be things like tobacco. Some of it will be things like controversial weapons, a lot of thermal coal. And so you screen out these things. And so there's been some pensions in the US because they're so focused on this ESG, and you'll have a state, let's call it the red states, who are not supporting some of those measures. And, you know, there's sort of backlash against the asset managers who have been so heavily focused on this ESG. You know, but again, if you're in Europe, you need to have that as basic screening. I mean, that this is like it's a very different mentality over there. And I thought, well, hey, this war in Ukraine, is that going to change their standard? Like, maybe this will change what's a good controversial weapon. Maybe it's going to change what is their view on energy policy, because that got them into a big mess. But apparently it is not. Everything I've heard so far is still, it's like a requirement to be investing in Europe.
Yeah, let me just read the tweet from the POTUS account. This is obviously President Biden. "I just vetoed my first bill. This bill would risk your retirement savings by making it illegal to consider risk factors MAGA House Republicans don't like. Excuse me. Your plan manager should be able to protect your hard-earned savings whether Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene likes it or not." Look, I guess that's one view. I guess the most objective thing that we can say about this is it's a very highly partisan statement.
Yes, there's no question. I said it was being politicized. We've looked at a lot of the data. We have found some of the data signals, and particularly have companies that, with scores that have been improving, sort of positive ESG momentum. It's something, I'm co-author with Professor Siegel on Stocks for the Long Run. The sixth edition came out. We have a chapter on ESG. We quoted some research from Rockefeller, who has done a big study on ESG momentum, and it showed, you know, positive returns to those, companies who had positive ESG momentum scores. Now, you know, the key thing is, does this get priced into the stocks, and do they start selling at higher multiples because there's demand for these things? Or is, on the other side, is there become such a cheapness to energy because these ESG investors are shunning all these stocks that they then become a much better investment? And perhaps energy supply hasn't been going up because there's been this lack of support. And that's, you know, creating some of the dynamics that make energy a much better investment because it's priced in a way that it does that. So there's this ESG trend, but then you say, what happens to the prices that reflect the forward-looking opportunities?
Yeah, and I think we just don't really have enough data to say definitively one way or another yet. There's the argument that you made there, essentially that you have these forward-looking companies that are innovative, that want to do things in new growth areas that they believe will be more efficient, create greater opportunities, and they get priced up. Conversely, the opposite argument is that there are folks out there who fear that it's going to create macroeconomic distortions, where you have the buy side folks being penalized for making rational economic decisions to meet sort of an arbitrary mandate in their view. At least that's how the argument goes, as I see it.
Yeah, I think it'll be interesting to see the future play out. I people have said Europe's ahead of the U.S. We'll see how much more comes, but it clearly is going to be politicized in the U.S., whereas in Europe, it's just a very different mentality.
Jeremy, spectacular show. I hope we can have you back again soon.
You know, anytime. I'm happy to. I always enjoy talking with you guys.
This was a great conversation. A lot of depth, a lot of detail, and we also covered the news cycle as well. Thanks so much for joining us. Really enjoyed this.
Thanks, Ash.
Hey, thanks again for watching Real Vision Daily Briefing. Tomorrow, we'll be back with Darius Dale, Michael Kulbaugh, and Andreas Stennis Larsson. Please, looking forward to seeing you. Join us again then.
What's up, revolutionaries? Thanks for tuning in to the Real Vision Daily Briefing. For more content like this, head over to realvision.com and get unfiltered access to the very best, brightest, and biggest names in finance.